This is Mary Flynn, one of the editors of Blackbird, and I'm sitting at VCU with Ron Smith, who was kind enough to give us a poem for Blackbird number 2. Let's go back to Ezra Pound, who had certainly sent many American poets to Italy. Didn't you go to an institute one summer and sort of study Pound in Italy?
First trip to Italy was to Murano, to what they call the Ezra Pound Center for Literature at Brunenburg Castle, where Pound's daughter, Mary Durakovich, lives. And Olga Rudge was there, too, when I was there in 1990. After Pound was released from St. Elizabeth's, he went there first, you know, after he crossed the ocean. He went to Murano, to Brunenburg Castle, to live with his daughter, and then he packed up and went to Venice, which was the city he, I assume, loved the most. I went to Italy to live in the Alps, thinking I was living in Italy. It's technically in Italy, but it's more Austrian, I think, than it is Italian. To study Pound, really to spend the whole summer reading the cantos and trying to figure out what I'd missed in the cantos. It was wonderful not only to live up in the Alps, but also to get down and into Italy proper and see Italy for the first time. Speaking of travel, Pound traveled all of his life.
Well, did he have a home?
I guess the place that was really his home of all the places was Rapallo, which is right there in Liguria where we were this summer. And I had that same experience in Rapallo when I went there in 1990. I had a guidebook, but I couldn't find the Pound sites. And so I would ask people, you know, hotel clerks, and they'd be standing right next to the building I was looking for, but they didn't know it was there. It had a plaque on the wall very clearly. But now, Pound loved Italy, there's no question about it. He seemed to settle down in Rapallo. I don't know how this is related to his psychological problem.
Or his political problem.
Yeah, I think it was mainly a psychological problem. Pound was very perceptive and thoughtful. How could he think Mussolini was a brilliant man and a great leader? That's a sign right there that he wasn't right, I think. Because I don't know anyone else, any other thoughtful person who has come to that conclusion. And Pound was in a perfect position to see that he was wrong, but something in his head wouldn't let him see he was wrong. I don't think of the cantos the way a lot of Poundians do. It's a book to open up and flip through from time to time, and of course go back to certain cantos and read them over and over again. The Pisan cantos are wonderful. But I think it's really his poetic notebook. He's jotting down practically everything in there. I don't often feel a great deal of pity for Pound, but there are two times when I really do, and that's when he was treated so badly after he was captured and was kept in the cage. You know, he was 60 years old or so and kept in a cage outside near Pisa. And the other thing that really makes me feel pity for him is I think that realization at the end of his life that it had not worked out, that the cantos were a big pile of fragments, and that what he thought he had been doing he had not done. And that's a terrible realization, I think, for someone like Pound, 50-year poem.
Yeah, thinking of travel and going back to the Odyssey, that epic poetry and travel seem to be tied together most of the time. You could call the cantos an attempt at an epic poem, I guess. And do you think that that's one of those sort of desires of many poets when they travel, is to sort of put together in their minds their own epic?
Well, I'm sure. I certainly never thought I was writing an epic when I wrote To Ithaca, although the title might suggest that. Pound, being the kind of gigantically ambitious poet he was, felt that he wouldn't be the ultimate Pound poet unless he had written an epic, since the epic is the ultimate form, I suppose. But I don't think he wanted to do the travel part exactly. It was intellectual travel in the case of Pound, rather than emotional travel or spiritual travel for the most part, or even travel through space. And I think that's one of the things that makes it a series of lyrics and fragments of lyrics rather than an epic poem. Because I do think an epic, despite Walt Whitman, does have to be a narrative. at least there has to be a narrative spine that pulls everything through and together.
Thinking of that, have in this issue of Blackbird, have you been to Norman Duby's poem?
I haven't, no. Tell
it
me
is
about
an epic.
Is it an epic? How long is it?
We have just the first section.
Uh-huh.
And it's fairly long. It's also set sometime in the future and involves travel.
Uh-huh.
So this is an issue that has a number of oddly connected pieces, that little serendipitous thing that will happen sometimes,
right,
that involve travel.
But it's not touring travel. It's travel with a destination.
It's travel with a destination, mm-hmm, that is partly mental or, mm-hmm, spiritual travel, is, mm-hmm, because it's talking about space rather than really limitless space, and
right,
to places in space rather than any terrestrial travel.
Oh, wonderful.
And also ties into to Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, the travel across the landscape is clearly travel into yourself, if it's interesting. In fact, I think that's what poetry does relentlessly, line after line, good poetry and great poetry. It breaks down the barrier between the inner and the outer.
Who, besides Mark Twain, have you looked at who has said something to you along those lines, particularly poets, besides Pam?
Well, I don't know. Herman Melville, you know, traveled in the Holy Land, and his reactions are extreme and extremely interesting. His reaction to the pyramids, which I've never seen, he was appalled by the pyramids. What he says about them is something like, they really just devastated his spirit. He was amazed by them, but horrified by them, I think. They were not like man-made things, and they were not natural. They were some terrible other sort of construction that really oppressed his spirit. For Melville, if I remember Clairol very well, all of the Middle East, all of Palestine anyway, was the Dead Sea, basically. Shelley wrote his best poems in Italy, and I was surprised as I reread Shelley in depth over the past year how much I liked Shelley and how much complexity of thought and maturity of thought I found in Shelley, because the last time I remember reading much Shelley, I found him to be rather immature. I expected to read Byron and Shelley in depth over the past year and find Byron much more interesting, and I had the opposite reaction. And Shelley was very much stimulated by partly being on the move, having to move from place to place, as Byron was, and partly by being in Italy, where every place you look it is interesting. One of the things that I love to do when we travel, and Dolores is a wonderful traveling companion in this regard, the destination. You know, we have to see as much of the Via Appia as possible and get to at least Capua, let's say, on this particular trip. But it's a flexible itinerary beyond that. Or we have to try to get all the way to Lecce, the end of the boot, but we'll take as long as it takes to get there. We get a car and we just go. We have no reservations. And drive until it's just about dark. This works all over Europe, I think. It certainly works in Italy and England. And as it's getting dark, since you don't want to drive after dark, it's hairy enough in the light, you go straight to the center of the nearest town, just follow the signs to Centro, and you get to the center of the town, and you find a hotel, and ask for a room, and well, a room with a view, and there you are. And usually in Italy, you're there at the time of the passeggiata. The entire village, the entire city turns out and walks up and down the main streets. So not only do you get to see the town, but you get to see everybody in the town all at once. This great sense of community. And I think things were different in the early to mid-19th century, but those poets found the same thing in Italy. Great sense of community and life lived outside more than inside. And of course, the vital life of the village right here, right now, right next to an Etruscan ruin or some such thing.
Do you think that's what's been the attraction for American poets or American writers, thinking of somebody like Henry James?
Hmm.
Was it the old civilization, the old existing side by side with the new, the different? The well, better food?
Well, it's the art to a large extent. Mm-hmm. Before reproductions were so widely available, you had to go to Rome and Florence just to see the art. You could see sketches of the art, but you couldn't really see it. And seeing a photograph of something like Michelangelo's David, even that is not the same, since the scale is part of the effect of the thing. There's so much to see in the Mediterranean that you could make up 1,000 excuses.
Or is this just a good reason to keep traveling?
Keep traveling, that's right. You know, I had a kind of a Wordsworthian childhood, I guess. I was an only child to the age of 10 and lived in Savannah, where it was somewhat tropical. And I spent a lot of my time just wandering outside by myself, just trying to find what was over the next hill or through the next stand of trees. There weren't many hills in all of Chatham County, actually. Down the railroad track without getting run over by the train. And, you know, when I went to the Lake District the first time, I felt like such an idiot because I've been reading Wordsworth. I think Wordsworth was the first poet I loved, as a matter of fact, in high school. And I've been reading Wordsworth all of my life, but I'd never been there. I never thought I needed to go there. But as soon as we drove into the Lake District area, into Grasmere, I realized I should have been there all along, because I do think that landscape explains the power of the literature you love and cityscape much more than you think it will. I took one look around and said, that's what the poems are really about. They're about nature, but it's nature domesticated almost. It's wildness domesticated in a weird sort of paradox. The Lake District is wild and has a wild beauty, but it's a manageable human scale. It's not like the Rockies or the Sierra Nevada. When we went to Dublin the first time, I'd heard all my life and had read Ulysses on my own, never had a course in Ulysses before I went there. I'd heard all these symbolic and metaphorical interpretations of Ulysses. And then I read that Joyce said if Dublin were destroyed tomorrow, it could be rebuilt stone by stone using his book. And that's almost true.
He wrote his brother frequently.
It's very literal.
Check on little things. Now, dear Stanislaus, tell me where this was.
Right. Can you see the clock from this corner? Because I want to use that. And I think we were at Sandy Mount Strand. And I always thought that passage in Ulysses was somewhat contrived, that Stephen Dedalus walking on the beach, that the sensibility creating the images was bending over backwards to make it feel like the wasteland. Although this is earlier in the year of the Wasteland. If anything, this influenced the Wasteland, not vice versa. But you go to Sandy Mount Strand when the tide is out, and it looks like a desert. The tide is way out. It's not a little strip of sand. It's a long plain of emptiness. And it makes perfect sense. The literal becomes the metaphorical. And that's what I think is interesting about what about the literature I love? The symbolics in the literal, the spirituals in the physical.
The same thing struck me when I went to St. Petersburg. Mm. I thought this is the only city that Nabokov could possibly have come from.
Ah, yeah. Beautiful, orderly, a little bit of a stage set.
And a great deal going on behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm.
Just in terms of the tormented political life.
Mm-hmm.
And just the beauty of it, the beauty of the surface.
Yes, and the vistas, the Roman vistas, really, is constructed like Renaissance Rome.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, what travel poems might you recommend to other folks that you have enjoyed reading that would give you a sense of the inner and outer space that the poet is occupying?
You know, the first person to do a lot of travel poetry in recent years, I think, it's probably Lawrence Lieberman, Larry Lieberman. He was doing whole books of travel verse before, at least in my experience, anybody else that I knew of. And I haven't looked at his recent stuff, but that'd be a place to look. I was really pleased to notice that in the Norton Book of Travel, a poem that had sprung into my mind, travel, quote-unquote, poem, is on first looking into Chapman's Homer, which is about reading, but it uses the vehicle of travel to tell what reading is like. I think it's a great travel poem. A wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. That's the experience that travelers get when they really have the experience. And Keats is writing about reading, not about traveling, and he's writing about people other than himself, and he's even got the wrong explorer, but he's got the experience of wonder that you get when you stand on a cliff and have it.
Well, why don't you find the poem and we'll end by having you read that.
Oh, great. On first looking into Chapman's Homer, much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his domain. Yet did I never breathe its pure serene, till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I, like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez, when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien.